Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston's history. This is episode 9, The Zoo Shipwreck. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. And this week, we're going to take a look at an oddity in Boston history. From the terrible gunpowder explosion aboard a moored ship in 1640 that killed all but one aboard, to the pleasure sailors who had to be rescued by a Coast Guard helicopter after their sailboat ran aground off Lovell's Island just last month, Boston Harbor is no stranger to shipwrecks. They're often terrifying, occasionally tragic, but they're very rarely this strange. When the freighter City of Salisbury ran aground in the harbor in 1938, Boston witnessed a shipwreck so odd that it's kept the city talking for over 75 years. But before we delve into shipwrecks, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
For superstitious Boston sports fans, Monday marks the anniversary of the Curse of the Bambino. Red Sox owner Harry Frazee traded Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees on December 26, 1919. For generations, Bostonians have said that the Babe was traded to fund one of Frazee's Broadway productions, but Frazee always said that it was because Ruth wasn't contributing enough to the team. For reference, the Yankees with Ruth won their first World Series title in 1923. The Sox with the Babe had won the World Series in 1915, 1916, and 1918, and without him, they wouldn't win again until 2004. And we'll post a link to an image of the transfer contract in the show notes.
On December 27, 1824, Boston voters defeated a city council proposal that would have developed and sold off the land that we now know as the Public Garden. For decades, the land was leased to rope makers. Rope walks were dangerous business, and it was important to have them on the outskirts of town in case of fire. Indeed, they burned in 1806 and again in 1819. After the second fire, the city bought the deed back with the intent of subdividing the land and selling it to raise funds. Residents had a different idea, and they passed an initiative banning the city from ever selling the land or using it for a cemetery. A few years later, the Public Garden was founded. I think residents made the right call.
Massachusetts officials laid out the neat street grid for a new town on December 28, 1630. They called the new town Newtown and intended for it to be the colony's capital. A few years later, a college was founded there, and today we know it as the town of Cambridge.
One if by land, two if by sea. Thursday marks the anniversary of the first public worship held at Old North Church in 1723. Of course, it wasn't old yet at that point. And Friday is December 30th, and that marks the anniversary of the first known concert in America. It was held in Peter Pelham's Great Room on Queen Street, which is now Court Street. Peter Pelham's third wife was Mary Copley, making him the father of engraver and mapmaker Henry Pelham, and stepfather to famed artist John Singleton Copley. The Queen Street Great Room where the concert was held was in a building where he ran a school, a studio, and a tobacco shop, and where both famous artists were brought up.
Many of us grew up celebrating New Year's Eve by watching the ball drop at midnight in Times Square. And I was surprised to learn that Boston used to have a time ball that would drop every day at noon. It was operated by the Harvard Observatory and synchronized with the U.S. Naval Observatory by telegraph. The time ball went into service in 1878, mounted on a 20-foot mast on the Equitable Building, where it could be seen for miles around. And this allowed ship captains in the harbor to set their chronographs, which, in turn, allowed them to accurately chart their course at sea with celestial navigation. And we'll have a link to a Brown University article about the time balls in Boston and Providence in this week's show notes.
Finally, Sunday is New Year's Day. On New Year's Day in 1776, a new flag was hoisted over the Patriot fortifications on Prospect Hill in Somerville for the first time. Known as the Grand Union flag, it had 13 red and white stripes, like the modern American flag, but instead of white stars on a blue field, the canton consisted of the British Union Jack. Today, it's considered the first national flag of the U.S. And if you're free at 11:30 a.m. on New Year's Day, you can catch the annual reenactment of this event at Prospect Hill Park near Union Square, complete with George Washington leading the procession on horseback. But now it's time to take a look at some more modern Boston history, as we examine the wreck of the city of Salisbury. Boston was an important port city for most of its history. We're relatively close to European ports, with a sheltered deepwater harbor. At the same time, it's a fairly treacherous port. The harbor islands do a great job of sheltering the inner harbor, but they also make the outer harbor hard to navigate. Though a deep channel has been dredged in modern times, President's Road and Nantasket Road were, for most of our history, the only navigable shipping channels, and they're both very narrow as they wind in between the islands.
Because the treacherous channels are so hard to navigate, there are multiple lighthouses in Boston Harbor. Boston Light, on Little Brewster Island, is the most famous of all. It was America's first lighthouse and is now the oldest operational light station in the U.S. It was first built in 1716, so, amazingly, it celebrated its tercentennial this year. We went out to visit it in June, and you can during the summer months as well.
Yeah, and expect to hear more shows about the history of Boston Light in the future.
The other very distinctive lighthouse that's still visible in Boston Harbor is Graves Light. Built on a rock outcropping far out in the outer harbor, Graves Light is the tallest and outermost lighthouse in the harbor. And if you're cruising through Boston Harbor, look carefully at Long Island Head. There's a lighthouse barely visible through the trees just uphill from Fort Strong, which we referenced in episode 5. Those lighthouses still remain, but when our story takes place, there were also lighthouses on Spectacle Island, Deer Island, Lovell's Island, and in the channel near George's Island as well. And in the days before GPS, these lighthouses helped guide ships into Boston Harbor.
Ships like the City of Salisbury, which is a 415-foot steam-powered freighter that displaced almost 6,000 tons.
That's a pretty big ship, right?
By the standards of the time, yes. But it's a fraction of the size of a modern container ship. I was curious about that, so I looked up how big a modern freighter would be. And it turns out that there are different standard sizes for different waterways around the world. The Panamax standard defines what ships can use the Panama Canal, which maxes out at 950 feet long and about 60,000 tons. And that's not even the largest standard.
So that's about twice as long and 10 times as heavy as the City of Salisbury.
Yes, but again, we're comparing it to other ships of its time. It was a pretty good-sized steamer. And we're not just talking about steamers here. Sailing ships happily coexisted with steam for decades. There are pictures of Boston Harbor full of both sailing vessels and steamboats well into the 20th century. I've even seen a 1935 photo of the harbor, where there are plenty of four-masted schooners tied up at the docks right next to steamboats. I'll see if I can dig that photo up for the show notes. But by that time, sail was far past its peak, still in some use. If you have the ship, you might as well sail it, and you wouldn't even have to pay for coal. Now, by the time the City of Salisbury arrived in Boston Harbor on April 22, 1938, it had traveled almost around the world. It was a British flag vessel, and it had traveled to India and Sri Lanka, and it loaded a cargo of jute, rubber, iron, tea, sugar, rice, silk, and tapestries. Then, from the Indian Ocean, it had traveled all the way to the east coast of North America, making a stop in Halifax before coming down to Boston.
You know, what makes the story interesting isn't the rubber or the silk, it's the animals that were aboard. One of the most valuable cargoes the ship carried was a load of exotic tropical animals destined for U.S. zoos. There were 40 pythons and 40 cobras, one of which ate its mate while at sea. Most records say he, but I have to imagine that that was a lady cobra. And 20 crates of exotic birds. And there was a Himalayan bear that got loose and wreaked havoc in Calcutta. And some 300 monkeys. And while they were docked in Halifax, about 24 monkeys got loose and rioted in the streets. We've featured a lot of Boston riots on the show so far, but this was a little different.
Yeah, I loved that idea of a monkey riot. So while we were getting ready to record this episode, I did some Googling, and I discovered that monkeys actually did riot in New Delhi, India in 2007. They actually killed a politician who was trying to fight them off. So, to fight the out-of-control monkeys, the authorities brought in bigger, scarier monkeys. We'll link to a brief BBC article about the New Delhi Monkey Riot, and the show notes for this week's episode.
Now, you just have to imagine how perplexed the citizens of Halifax must have been while this was happening.
So you can imagine that after such a long, eventful voyage, Captain William H. Lewis was looking forward to the end of his journey. He must have looked at Gravesite off his bow with a certain sense of relief. As they approached the outer harbor, the weather was clear, but as the ship then maneuvered northeast of Gravesite, a fog bank moved in and reduced visibility. Boston Harbor has 34 islands, sandbars, and narrow channels. Even today, navigating in the tight quarters of the harbor in the fog can be nerve-wracking. But Captain Lewis had every reason to be confident. His map, Government Chart number 246, said that there was 33 feet of water under his keel. So imagine his surprise when, with a terrible groan, the ship came to a sudden and complete stop. They were stuck on a previously uncharted rock outcropping, a kind of spire or pinnacle of rock sticking straight up from the seafloor.
Now, Captain Lewis might have preferred not to make history by discovering new land on this voyage.
But he didn't have a choice. Though there were some questions about that, and in fact an investigation later, he was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing, and Government Chart number 246 was found to be faulty. Now, in the hours immediately after the wreck, all the animals and most of the crew were taken off the ship in local vessels. 14 sailors and 4 officers remained on board to help with recovery efforts. The problem is that a ship is meant to be cradled and supported by the water it floats in, but now the Salisbury was only supported by a small ledge of rock. As the tide receded around the ship the next morning, it started to groan and the hull buckled under its own weight. The men aboard hurried aft, and then the ship broke in half just ahead of the smokestacks. The forward half rolled over and sank quickly out of sight. The stern shifted around, sending a scare through the men who remained on board, but then settled back onto the rock. We'll have pictures of the ship as it was stranded on the rocks and at the moment it broke in half in this week's show notes.
As the ship broke up, the skeleton crew was taken off by a Boston tug that had ventured near the uncharted ledge to bring them to shore. Efforts to recover the valuable cargo continued throughout the summer. Including both the animals and the other goods on board, the cargo was worth almost $2 million, in 1938 dollars, which makes it the richest cargo ever wrecked in Boston Harbor. The stern was precariously perched on the ledge, but still somehow managed to survive the hurricane of September 1938, one of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit New England. It was finally a nor'easter the following month that did the city of Salisbury in. The high winds drove the stern off the rocks, and it finally slipped beneath the waves. A photographer captured that moment when it slipped out of sight, and we'll have that photograph in the show notes as well. While the bow section was under 80 feet of water, the stern section was still almost at the surface. Over the next few months, divers blew up parts of the stern with dynamite to clear the navigation hazard, and sections that could be brought up were sold as scrap.
Between the storms and the dynamite, the city of Salisbury today is little more than an underwater scrap heap. However, that doesn't stop it from being a popular destination with local scuba divers. In fact, one group discovered and recovered the city of Salisbury's anchor in 1995, bringing it ashore in Salem and restoring it for display. We'll have a photo taken by divers at the wreck of the city of Salisbury in 2014 in the show notes for this week's episode. Gravesite still stands as the outermost sentinel in Boston Harbor, but it's also taken on a new life. The government put it up for auction in 2013, and a local couple bought it. While it still shines its beacon to ships at sea, it's also being renovated as a weekend getaway for the new owners. They've been keeping a blog of their unique home makeover project, and we'll post a link to that in the show notes as well.
Hopefully, if we promote their blog, they'll invite us over for drinks this summer.
Fun! All right, where can people find out more about the wreck of the city of Salisbury?
We'll have a lot of great photos in the show notes for this week's episode at hubhistory.com/009. We'll have photos of the ship on the rocks, the ship breaking in half, animals being taken off the ship, and the moment that it finally sank. We'll also have modern photos of the wreck site taken by a scuba diver and a few pictures of the Boston Light and Graves Light in Boston Harbor. We'll post a link to the City of Salisbury's logbook, the Graves renovation blog, and a link to a BBC article about the monkey riot in New Delhi. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com or go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you are there, click on subscribe and make sure you never miss an episode.
And I'll let you in on a secret. Nikki handles Facebook for us while I take care of Twitter. So if you want to harass me, I'm on Twitter as @HubHistory. But if you want to pester Nikki, check out facebook.com/HubHistory. That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show on the grisly 1801 murder-suicide attempt by Jason Fairbanks.